Right now, as I'm recording this, a hacker who goes by Nightmare Eclipse is dropping working Windows exploits into the open internet, one after another, with no warning to Microsoft and no fix waiting. Microsoft has banned the accounts, sent legal threats, and reportedly brought in the police. The hacker, who claims Microsoft ruined their life, calls this the bill coming due. A few of those exploits have already hit real people, so this story is messier than one hacker against a giant. But the most dangerous hacker in it never wrote a single exploit. They have a corner office and a seat on the board. And the quiet budget decision they keep making puts more people in danger than Nightmare Eclipse ever could. Hi nerds, I'm Addie. I've been in cybersecurity for 15 years and I break down cyber threats before they blindside you. To show you how that person became the real threat, I have to take you through the hackers everyone got wrong, the revolt where the best researchers alive said no more free bugs, and the woman with the pink hair who tried to fix the whole thing. By the end, you'll know exactly who's been deciding your software isn't actually worth protecting. Let's get into it. Hackers were never your problem. Let's start with the word hacker, because the movies did a number on it. You picture a hoodie and Monster energy drink in a dark room breaking in to ruin your day. The people I'm talking about are closer to the opposite of that visualization. They're researchers who find a flaw in something you use, for example, a banking app, browser, or Windows itself, and their first instinct is to tell the company so it gets fixed before a criminal finds the same door. I'm going to call this what it is. This is free labor. Someone spends weeks of their own time finding a defect in a billion-dollar company's product, then hands it over so that that company's customers stay safe. If a stranger found a structural crack in an apartment building and mailed the landlord the blueprints to fix it, you would call it a gift. But for most of the history of software, companies treated that gift as a threat. So what actually happened to the researchers who handed it over anyways? When the thank you was legal action. Here's how it used to go. And honestly, still how a lot of it goes, including Microsoft and their disappointing new strategy. A researcher finds a serious flaw. They email the company quietly, the responsible way, expecting maybe a thank you. But what comes back is a legal threat. Stop testing our product, take down your post, or we'll see you in court. And for years, telling a company about a hole in its software was one of the fastest ways to get yourself sued. From the company's side, that was a cold profit calculation, and the customer was the one left exposed. A flaw nobody has reported costs nothing on the balance sheet. A flaw someone reports is suddenly your problem to fix, and fixing it costs money, while admitting it costs face. So the cheap move was to make the messenger go away and keep the building looking okay. But now sit in the researcher's chair. You did the right thing for free, and you got threatened for it. Meanwhile, you're holding something that other people, the wrong people, will secretly pay you real money for. The company made the honest path expensive and humiliating, and left exactly one path open that actually paid them for their labor. By the late 2000s, the entire industry was balanced on that contradiction. So what happens when a few of the best hackers alive decide they're done absorbing the cost? No more free bugs. In 2009, at a security conference in Vancouver called CanSec West, three of the most respected exploit researchers alive, Charlie Miller, Alex Sotarov, and Dino Dai Zovi, stood up and put four words on the table that became a movement. No more free bugs. Finding a real vulnerability is hard, specialized work, and it carries a clear market value because buyers were already lining up to pay for it. So why would a researcher do that work and hand it to a trillion-dollar company for nothing while that same company threatened to sue them for the trouble? They were asking to stop being the only people in this whole deal expected to work for free. This is what the media conveniently ignores when a researcher goes scorched earth and the coverage calls them unstable villains. The movement asks for one thing, the value of the work acknowledged in the only language a company reliably reads, which is money. No More Free Bugs was a labor movement as much as it was a rebellion, and the researchers turned out to be completely right about that market, which left every company a choice it had spent years dodging. Keep treating the people who could save you as a threat, or finally learn how to pay them for their work. So who actually worked out how to do that second part without the whole thing collapsing into chaos? The woman who built the bridge. That someone was Katie Mosoris. And more of that bridge is her work than almost anyone else's. It runs from we refuse to work for free to here's how you pay us properly. Now the bug bounty itself is older than most people realize, and she didn't invent it. A Netscape engineer named Jarrett Ridlinghofer coined the term and ran the first one back in 1995. And you can trace the rough idea even further to a company in 1983 that offered hackers a Volkswagen Beetle for finding bugs in its software. What Mosoris did was harder than inventing it. She took something the industry still treated as a complete gimmick and turned it into a system that the biggest companies in the world and eventually the US government would actually run. In 2013, working inside Microsoft, she built Microsoft's first bug bounty program, a formal system that paid researchers to report flaws instead of threatening them for it. In 2016, she helped the US Department of Defense launch Hack the Pentagon, the first time the federal government openly invited hackers to break into its systems on purpose, because it finally understood that friendly hackers finding the holes first is the much better outcome. Then she left to start her own company, Luda Security, teaching organizations how to run these programs in a way that treats the researcher as an ally instead of a suspect. She's also, and I mean this warmly, impossible to miss, usually with bright pink hair and one of the clearest voices in the field on this exact problem. So I'll say the thing a lot of us are actually thinking while Microsoft spends this month at war with a researcher and reaching for its lawyers. Given how that's going, it might be time to call Katie back, because the bridge she built has a toll on it. So why do so many companies still decide, on purpose, that they'd rather not pay it? The call is coming from inside the boardroom. Here's the reframe I promised you earlier, the one that most of my field probably won't say out loud and on camera. When a breach happens, everyone goes looking for the insider threat. They think it's the rogue employee or the contractor who clicked the suspicious phishing link or even the angry researcher dropping exploits. We almost never name the insider who does the most damage because that is the person who signs the checks. Executives are the biggest insider threat. Executives make this trade with open eyes. They choose profit over the people who trust them, and the incentives reward it every single time. Look at the math a board actually sees. Equifax exposed 147 million people in 2017, and its settlements landed somewhere around 575 to 700 million against roughly 3 billion in annual revenue. Then Target's 2013 breach hit 40 million cards and settled for about 292 million against $70 billion a year, well under 0.5% of a single year. When paying the fine for a breach reliably costs less than preventing it, a board will quite literally choose the breach, and its customers are the ones who absorb the cost. To them, the security team is expensive and an optional cost center, right up until the morning that it isn't. But then they'll simply choose to sacrifice the CISO, who has been warning them about this for ages, after it happens and move on. And now there's a modernized version of this vibe plaguing companies now. The move in a lot of boardrooms is to lay off the experienced security people and bet that a handful of AI tools can cover the gap, because the tools are cheaper this quarter and the salaries are not. The people who genuinely understand how a system breaks are the ones who look costly on a spreadsheet and turn out to be irreplaceable only after they're gone. Swapping them for something cheaper is an explicit decision that they value saving money over their own company. And you don't have to imagine how that goes, because Meta just showed everyone. To lean on cheaper automated support, Meta replaced customer support to let its AI chatbot do real account work, things like relinking an email or triggering a password reset, and it never once checked whether the person asking actually owned the account. And side note, I usually try to stay neutral here, but I don't know who the Meta signed off on this, but they were clearly brain dead. So attackers asked the bot to move a target's Instagram over to a new email, and the bot dutifully sent the one-time code, and they walked straight in. They seized high-profile accounts that way, including the old Obama White House account and the one belonging to the Chief Master Sergeant of the Space Force, until Meta caught it at the end of May and pulled the tool. The only accounts it couldn't touch were the ones whose owners had turned on two-factor themselves. And I don't really understand why Obama did not have on two-factor authentication. That's beside the point. A trained support rep whose whole job is verifying ownership does not simply hand over the keys like that, but their cheaper replacement did, at scale. And the same year, just a few months earlier, Meta laid off around 8,000 people, cybersecurity included, and funneled the money straight into more AI, which is about the dumbest possible move to make while your own AI is handing strangers the keys to people's accounts. This is what I mean when I say the threat is already inside. It shows up as a cost-saving decision that trades your safety for the quarter, made by people who count on being in a different job by the time the bill arrives. So what is that bill actually asking these companies to pay? Why the bill always comes due? Now let's put real numbers on what companies are actually being asked to pay, because the gap is the whole drama. A bug bounty might pay a researcher a few hundred dollars, or for something serious at a generous company, tens of thousands. Now the other side of the market, who are brokers who sell to governments, pay $5 to $7 million for one reliable way into an iPhone, and at least one Russian firm has publicly offered as much as $20 million. And those prices climb something like 44% a year. So a researcher with a serious flaw stands in front of two doors. Behind door one, you can report it responsibly, work through the company's lawyers and delays, and perhaps collect maybe $20,000, if they pay at all and don't try to put you in jail. Or door two, sell it quietly for 100 times more and never field a single complaint. Bug bounties exist to make door one tempting enough that good people keep choosing it. That's the entire purpose of them. They're the single moment a company competes for the loyalty of the only people who can fully take it apart. Plenty of companies still treat that competition as an indignity. They cap the payouts, shrink the rules so half the work doesn't even count, and they stretch a fix to 9 months, and they keep the researcher at arm's length in the dark the entire way. And that, in the end, is how you arrive at a nightmare eclipse. Treat enough talented people as a nuisance for long enough who are doing you a favor. Exploit and underpay them, pun intended, while the other side is waving millions, and eventually one of them stops cooperating. They chose to put real users in harm's way, and that part is theirs to answer for. The conditions that keep producing people like Nightmare Eclipse are a literal design choice, made by one budget meeting at a time. So what does the opposite choice actually look like? What companies who want to survive actually do. I've helped set up a responsible disclosure program, so let me tell you what the other path looks like, because it's simple and it's pretty cheap compared to losing your company. A real program starts from one assumption: the researcher knocking on the door is doing you a favor, so you better act like it. You publish clear rules so people know what's fair game, give them a real human to talk to about the fix, you pay a fair price, and you fix the flaw on a same timeline while crediting them publicly for the catch. The whole thing exists to protect the people using your product, your company, and a better reputation turns out to be the side effect of doing that honestly. Most of the work is simply deciding that the people protecting you are on your side. So here's where I land. The companies treating security as a cost to minimize, trading their experts for cheaper tools and AI and their researchers for legal threats, are quietly arranging their own funeral, and they'll call it an attack whenever it arrives, when it's their own doing. They are the real insider threat, and they deserve every ounce of what's coming to them, but their users do not. The ones who choose to pay the people who keep them alive, in money and in respect, are buying themselves a future most of their competitors are spending down. Bug bounties were never charity, and they were never really about the hackers. They're a company deciding, with open eyes, to keep the people who could end it on its own side. That decision is still sitting on the table for every company watching this. And almost every time, the bill is smaller than they think, right until it isn't. If you like this video about the real insider threat, you'll love this one all about passkeys. I'll see you in that video next.